If you don't have sound money at the top,
boom, you got it. I'm like, I love it. That's literally the essence of my thesis. Thank you.
A country needs those four pillars, the foundation, if real. So I suggest a fifth
pillar.
That's
what I was just gonna say.
And you said it. No, you said it already, which is incredible. 18.6% of U.S. adults owning or having exposure to Bitcoin. That's it. An emerging voting bloc that is voting on decentralized technology. You cannot unsee it if you're a politician, unless you want to risk losing. And if people in D.C. don't like losing. Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm super, super excited. I had a little difficulties logging in, but this is awesome. So okay. Full out studio here online. Okay.
Yes, I know. It's great. I love it. So thank you so much for joining today. And yeah, it's this is a great platform to be able to talk to Bitcoiners. So I learned about it from some of the other podcasters who had me on. So this is what I stuck with.
But I love your background too. That's I just got a copy of that book, the Bitcoiner, the one on the left from Dr. Kaufman. That's great.
Oh yes,
nice.
Isn't it awesome? I love it. It's such a cool cover, but it's got so much nice art inside too. So we're one of the first. Well, I guess like he sent out some first copies, like the first 25, but then he's selling it, I think, on Amazon too or something. But it's a great book. I'm so excited that he did this, and it looks great on the shelf. So it's amazing.
I love it. And the shoes. I'm a big fan of your show. I think that you're part of the emerging Bitcoin political economy. And I love your vibe. I love it. Thanks for being up for the invite. I'm excited.
Thank you. Thanks for being a fan and watching. And I'm glad you like the shoes. I love Satoshi shoes. Like they're the cool, like they're all I want to wear now. Like I don't want to leave the house unless I'm wearing a pair of these because, you know, it's not like you're just showing, you're not just showing off Bitcoin. You're kind of creating a conversation starter too. And then it's also just planting seeds. So even if people are just seeing it, they're kind of like, oh, what's that Bitcoin thing? So it's just a great way for people to just kind of like start asking questions. So yeah, thank you. Thanks for being a fan and thanks for watching. And I am so excited when you messaged me because you were talking to me about Bitcoin policy and what you're doing. You're writing an article for a Substack. And I like how your account, you talk about connecting the dots and you like to connect different.
Thank you. Thank you.
Politics and Bitcoin. So I want to hear more about that. So yes, everybody, this is Sal Pineda. Did I pronounce that right?
You did. Yep. You got it right. Okay. Yep.
Okay. And you are a former diplomat and you are Cornell MBA.
Yep.
And so you were, when you messaged me, you were going to DC for the Bitcoin Policy Institute conference. Is that what
That's
it
right.
was?
Yep. You remember. Okay. That's it. Yep. I remember.
So how was that?
Where to start? So since that message to, and I think we connected a little bit before that, after Vegas, the Vegas conference, because I remember seeing your interview with Jeff Booth, and it just, you know, anything with him is always, I'm always like, all right, I see Jeff Booth, let me take my notes and learn. So I think since we connected that time to now, I'm actually going live with, so let me backtrack a little bit. So I served in DC as a diplomat for 5 years and, more or less about 5 years. And I went to Georgetown to the School of Foreign Service. So I was trained. I have a master's from there. I did a specialty in Latin American studies, international development. And I really was able to, you know, I was in DC connecting with multilaterals, like the Organization for American States, which is like a mini UN for the American continent from Canada to Argentina. So dealing with, you know, all the countries in between in matters of human rights, national security. So I really got to see DC from that policy perspective. And obviously I'm a longtime resident from there, 20 some years. And I think that coming back after being here in Cornell, with the finance perspective, the MBA that I was able to get, really made me understand that the fine tuning of what's happening in the political economy of Bitcoin. And I think that, you know, this is, I'm happy to share it here. In a few hours, I will be uploading live. I'm open sourcing in the ethos of Bitcoin, about 7,800 word, document like a blueprint on a snapshot of the emerging political economy within the context of the U.S., right? Yeah. And I think that being in the space since class of 2017, we're well past the time that Bitcoin is only associated with money laundering and all the FUD that some people keep on repeating, but we're well past that. So I took the time to, I invested about several hundred hours in this document that I'll be uploading on Twitter. And on a really brief summary. Then I'm going to open source it through Substack. It's just there so folks can see what's happening from an analytical perspective. And what I realized was, Vegas is a geopolitical conference at this point. You have plebs, billionaires, regulators, human right defenders. I mean, it's incredible. That's geopolitics, at its core.
Right.
Then in DC, you have strictly policy. And to see that within the realm of what this means for a decentralized, unkillable system like Bitcoin, I've invested several hundred hours sharing my insights. So that will be open source. It's coming wow. soon. You get a specific shout out, you on your show. I think I provide a snapshot, then I sort of provide a framework of 21 winners, who's winning. I think journalism, podcasters, and educators is all one. And that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It's like hornets, right? I believe Michael Saylor said the cyber hornets, where sure, the FUD can continue, whether that's the European Union, the US, whether regulators from all over, private sector as well. But we need more, not less podcaster, more, not less education, because it is this grassroots connection. Right, with when you go out with your shoes, when I go, right now I'm reading again this paper I was able to get, the Satoshi papers, right? It's I just finished this one again, which is amazing, the Bitcoin dollar.
Which one is the Satoshi paper one?
Oh, it's incredible. It was put out. This one analyzes, it's sort of reflections on the political economy after Bitcoin, edited by Natalie, and it's incredible. It's sort of like an aggregate of incredible thought leaders. And we can share the link with the readers if you want. But it's phenomenal. It was put out by the BPI, Bitcoin Policy Institute. And it is just incredible how you see the perspective from different thought leaders, right? And what Bitcoin will do, not just to the ecosystem, but to the world. Right.
It describes all that, but does it also include the Satoshi emails in there for people that haven't read them?
Not to my knowledge. It doesn't include that. It's more of like high level perspective on what happens as, like, for example, I'll read to you a little bit of, which is incredible, I think. Here we go. So what they did, right, the contributors, and I'm sure the readers are familiar, they talk about sort of what is at stake, what Satoshi did, with Professor Bailey and Professor Craig Warnke, toward an anthropological theory of money, easy money, easy wars, the evolution of war finance, which is an incredible piece by Professor Sarah Krebs, who I had the pleasure to, and I'm still affiliated and supporting the research that she's leading at Cornell, on sort of exploring global Bitcoin adoption and seeing that. There was an incredible presentation she did at the BPI conference, so maybe we can send that link to on the video. It's incredible. I recommend for everyone to see, just so they get a snapshot of real life data. This is a global survey, and she explains the methodology of where is Bitcoin being adopted, where is it not being adopted, and for what purpose, right? Some people use it because they need it for remittances. Other ones use it to store their wealth, right? So no, everybody can huddle for 8 years. Some people need it right now because they're being persecuted by government oppression, and they need to escape with it, right? So this book is highly recommended. But it's obviously a more broader perspective, and just in general, I anticipate a Cambrian explosion of sort of educators like yourself. I think this is important. I think that this is how we are able to strengthen the network even more. Obviously, Bitcoin doesn't care, which is incredible. It's the only asset I think that that has ever done that in history, but we can all do our part to support it, right? So that's that's coming live, and it will be posted on Twitter tomorrow. It will be open sourcing the whole thing.
Check out the Bitcoin Advisor. Use my QR code to get expert options on multi-sig Bitcoin custody. These are the white paper shoes. I love them. Use my link in the description or the comments below for 10% off your order.
I wish I would have recorded the talk I had yesterday with one of our friends, because like you said, like people just, they hear what they hear about Bitcoin, and it's like a big game of telephone. Like they're just hearing what they heard from another person, and they're not taking the time to form their own opinions. So when I was talking to my friend last night, I think we had a 2-hour conversation, and it was like a podcast. I wish I would have recorded it.
Love
I could
it.
Share that too. He was just very confused on things that he's heard and about how it could affect different things in the world. And, you know, he just had all these questions, and I was able to clarify it for him in a simple way, because he kept saying, just slow it down, break it down for me. I don't understand anything you're saying. So just like slow it down. So I would tell him in the most simplest way possible. And by the time he left, he was like, that's it. I'm selling any XRP I have, and I'm Bitcoin only. So I'm like, that made me feel so good, because people need to just hear what this is. You know, politicians need to hear about how it could benefit the world in different ways. People need to hear. So the more people that do podcasts and share their knowledge, and if people can understand one person versus another, it could help something click for them so they actually get it. So that's why, yeah, I agree that's important. I didn't know that my voice would make a difference in this space when I first started, but I just want to, you know, encourage, like, you know, congratulate you for doing what you're doing and putting your voice out there.
Thank
and
you.
Spreading education and awareness to the policymakers, and to see how, because if nobody does it and everyone sits back, you know, it's just, you know, yeah, it'll happen still. Like you said, Bitcoin doesn't care, but it'll happen so much slower. And we would like more people to get involved, for it to be more decentralized, and for more people to benefit from this before it's just adopted by major corporations. You know, we want to get more people in on it too, but it can definitely help this inflation problem in different countries if they adopt a Bitcoin standard.
You know, and this is super interesting, Stacey, because if we pause here, I think if I hear you correctly, and I agree with you, Bitcoin doesn't care, but policy influences who benefits from it. And mm-hmm. and that last part can be very controversial within even the Bitcoin culture, right? And there's a spectrum of people that want zero government, people that want little government, people that say, hey, let's coexist with the government, people that say, hey, let's actually ban it. So, there's a spectrum of Bitcoiners, but within this spectrum, and I was able to see, connected with folks and investors, stakeholders, policyholders, business owners, human rights defenders. And that's sort of the piece that I really pour my heart into it. That I'll be open sourcing, because policy does matter to protect and support the ethos of who can benefit from Bitcoin. Otherwise, you're right, very, very, very detrimental things can happen. It can be full out abolished. We all make fun of the Chinese ban. I think they just banned it again a couple of days ago. It's been several times that they banned Bitcoin, but it really can create more friction for the user, right? So we ultimately want to be able to, hey, if people want to use Bitcoin and not pay capital gains taxes in the US, then there should be an advocacy process for that. Mm-hmm. Right. And
the one thing
go ahead.
I wonder if you have a take on this, but I wonder if, because in my view, it's if Americans or if the US politicians don't adopt Bitcoin and don't understand its power, which I think they do. It's just, it baffles me why it's so slow to get adopted. And there are a lot of people who just don't understand it, and they need to figure out why it's important. But if they don't create policy around Bitcoin, if they don't understand it and they fight against it or ban it, if that's what the government thinks that they're going to do, people will just leave and go to a country where it's free. If they got into Bitcoin early, then you're going to have a majority of people who do become wealthy off of the Bitcoin they've held for years. And those people that are some of the wealthiest people, going forward, will end up just leaving and going to a country where they feel more free. So it's like, you will destroy. You will not have these people in your country that have benefited from Bitcoin that do have accumulate a lot of wealth in the world because of attacking it or trying to ban it, whereas the rest of the world needs Bitcoin because of the US dollar and what it's done to the rest of the world currencies and how they've collapsed against the dollar and will continue to do in sort of a domino effect way. So I just think that if the US doesn't do this and do it fast enough, I feel like they're just shooting themselves in the foot. I don't know.
Well, that's, totally I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I think I get excited talking about politics. So I did this for a living for years, but
yeah.
Donald Trump, when signing the Genius Act, I believe, or one of the acts a couple of weeks ago, and I quote this in this paper because I actually downloaded the transcript. He says something to the end of, and I'm paraphrasing here, I see value, comma, but I also did it for the votes. And let me tell you, you all came out and voted. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. I provide a direct quote in the paper. This is the first ever U.S. sitting president to acknowledge the emerging voting bloc of an entirely new, I mean, it didn't exist before Bitcoin. There was no crypto voting block, right? And we can talk about the difference in Bitcoin and crypto and how some special interests thrive on obfuscating that, right? On making sure it's yeah. unclear. But beyond that, we have a sitting U.S. president at the White House saying, one, hey, Bitcoiners and the crypto ecosystem, wow, you all actually showed up to vote. Two, being a DC resident and being in that ecosystem, nobody, Democrats or Republicans, goes to DC if they don't want to win.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to,
you have
a
great point.
Go ahead.
You have a great point because there are, you know, I actually looked up a stat today, interestingly enough, but I looked up a stat to see, because I told my friend yesterday that about 3% of the world owns Bitcoin right now. And our other friend was asking us today, is that true? Is it 3%? I'm like, let me look it up. I'm not sure about that. So I double checked and it says that about 1.29% of the global population owns Bitcoin, but another site says maybe 4%. So right in that range. Yep. But it said that 14% of Americans own Bitcoin. And that stat could be wrong too, because Americans could have multiple wallets. They could have, five wallets, who knows? So it's not exact, but let's say it's, 8% of Americans own Bitcoin. 8% is a big enough chunk of Americans who care about sound money and who are sick of the theft that's going on. So if you want to win as president and you have this swing, the swing states and you have,
right.
Well, what group of voters can we get so we could win this election? It's like, you better win over the Bitcoiners if we're going to be enough of a swing vote for people to, to win or not win. So, and this is going to grow over time, right?
Yes, 1,000%. And just to give you, adding to your point, there's at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, Professor Troy Cross and his colleague, they founded something that's going to have the stats here on my other screen. So pardon, I'm looking that way. They have something that's called the Nakamoto Project. And pretty much they just put out, they announced it at the BPI conference. They did the survey and they showed their, their statistical model and whatnot. But they found out that within the snapshot right of this last year, I believe, this last few quarters, they report that about 48 million people in the U.S. of U.S. adults report exposure to Bitcoin, whether through direct holdings, spouse or partners, or ETF exposure. And within that group, based on the Nakamoto Project's 2025 report, and this is all open source, is available on their website. Maybe we can link it for the user, the viewers. They report that 11 million people in the U.S., so roughly 4.2% of adults, self-custody in different ways their Bitcoin. So when you start thinking, to your point, there's, depending on what states people live, if elections are won on margins, tiny margins, a landslide is maybe a 2-3% difference. And if Bitcoiners are represented with, 18.6% of U.S. adults owning or having exposure to Bitcoin, that's an emerging voting bloc that is voting on decentralized technology to protect their life savings, eventually they will pass a bill to politicians. They will pass a bill in a good or bad way, right? If there is support, we'll reward it. And Bitcoiners also, this study found out, tend to care a little bit more, heightened a little more about everything, whether that's conservative Bitcoiners, liberal Bitcoiners. They tend to, in general, be more passionate. And that, I think you and I can confirm that in general from our interactions in the culture. But just adding to your perspective, you're spot on. You're absolutely right. Yeah. This is becoming more important. And I will say in this paper, I'm saying at this point, you cannot unsee it if you're a politician, unless you want to risk losing. And if people in DC don't like losing.
Yes, exactly. That's such a great point. And I love how you mentioned that about the stats, because if you think about a household, and if it's the spouse buying Bitcoin, but they discuss it together and they make these decisions together as a family. So even if it's saying one of the spouses in these data collection, you know, however they do it, studies, I don't know what they call it. But if one of the spouses buys Bitcoin, that means that literally it's double, because if, let's say some of these people are married or they have kids that are old enough to vote, that their family, you know what I mean? Like the whole family is a Bitcoin family at that point. Right. So it's not just that one holder of Bitcoin. It could be a whole family that has this mindset.
That's right.
So it's much larger than even, you know, just the person holding it. So that's
absolutely
really interesting.
Mm. Absolutely. I love your perspective, and I validate it. I think you're going to enjoy my paper. It's, you know, the first one that I was able to publish sort of talks about Bitcoin at a global level, right? And having, you know, having experience, having lived in El Salvador and having experience, unfortunately, government oppression, I see it's very personal to me. Bitcoin is very personal. It's very real. It does matter, right? When you have government forces kidnapping your father or assaulting your mother when you're 8, 9 years old, right? And we left within like 72, 96 hours to the U.S. I mean, when they released my father, who survived, you know, will survive. You can't bring your things with you. Guess what happens to your house and your car and when something like that happens?
Yeah.
Right? So we luckily, you know, we survive. Many people don't through emerging markets that deal with that social instability. But my whole life,
you grew up that way. Like that's how your family life was. Like it was like your father was attacked.
Yeah, we came to this country, to the U.S. I'm a proud U.S. citizen. It took us 14 years to become naturalized. A lot of time, but we came here. I believe it was summer '01, right before the 9/11 attack. And my father was kidnapped and tortured. He was released. He survived, which is a blessing. And a couple of years before that, my mom and I were assaulted by government death squads. We came here. The government was granted us political asylum. That then turned into, you know, the typical legal process. You become a resident, then you become a U.S. citizen.
You were kidnapped by who?
What's that?
Who kidnapped him?
What was found out through sort of the whole journey, the trial, was that it was, you know, government forces, death squads, right? We don't know the name, obviously.
I know, yeah.
But
I just thought maybe was it a random attack or was it government?
We were afforded political asylum, which is, you know, we're grateful that was provided to us, by the U.S. government, and it, you know, we're That's lucky to have saved. Yeah, well, you know what? There's something that's called, and I Bitcoiners, right? There's an order of operations to Bitcoiners that I realize. Typically, when you become a Bitcoiner, and I say this from my own personal experience, four things happen, right? Once you really understand what Bitcoin means to you, and it could mean many things, right? You're a multi millionaire, and you see your wealth melting away, so you become a Bitcoiner. Nothing wrong with that. There's no moral judgment, right? But also it could be something like my story, right? It's like, holy moly, we came to this country, lost everything, and I spent my whole life trying to understand, why did we go through what we went through? I went to Georgetown just thinking I would be able to fix the world through politics, and I understood that, oh my God, this is a lot more nuanced than that, than running a campaign and winning. And now that I've had the MBA and I've been I've been working as an experienced consultant and founder, I understand that one of the biggest ways is that you can have meaningful impact is by your allocation of your private capital, right? Whatever that might be, whether you're, you know, whatever you focus on expands, right? And if I focus on earning fiat that's being debased every year, then that's a problem. You know, that's a problem because it means that I have to work harder and harder. And this has been debased with none of my permission, none of my authorization. There's no agency there. So the only thing that exists that is backed by thermodynamic energy, by actual real world energy, like there's a kinetic element to it, it's the Bitcoin network, us, right? All of us, right? So to your point, I think that the Bitcoiners, right, whether, or, you know, and unfortunately, my story is all too common. So, you know, it's a lot of folks go through a lot of pain. In general, Bitcoin forces you to have a truth-telling process. It's like, okay, and Jeff Booth talks about this. I mean, you talked about it. He mentioned it in your interview where if I am going to benefit from this system, what does this mean? What is the system? Why am I making more fiat money and at what expense? And there's some very uncomfortable truths there. Right. You know, no judgment to anyone, just the process I've observed that in general people that understand Bitcoin go through. It's like, okay, wow. All right. So this is the truth telling. This is what it means if I don't buy some Bitcoin, rather if I don't invest in Bitcoin, it means that I support XYZ. However you see the world, right? That's very, that changes by people. Then the second step, and I allude to this in the paper, the first paper that was published, where the second pillar of the Bitcoiner is you have to go then through a process of prosecution. Like you have to prosecute and really stress test. You really have to test your beliefs and see which ones are anchored by thermodynamic truth and which ones are anchored by a fiat-based scarcity mindset. Only, and this is literally the process of transitional justice, that's how I'm able to tie human rights. I mean, I literally, like, this is, you know,
I want to hear about that.
Well, yeah, I know this would be a good segue. You know, transitional justice is nothing more than a way in which academics and sort of practitioners in the field of conflict and peace studies and whatnot process and try to help and support societies transitioning from conflicts. Like El Salvador after the Civil War, you know, I'm from there. I was born there. Into when the war ends, what happens? Right? What happens to the people that were massacred by all the warring parties? What happens to the folks that were trained to massacre? How do you integrate that? How can you go through? And obviously, society since the dawn of humanity has had conflict, so this is not new to specific regions. But transitional justice just helps explain that. And sort of the overall consensus seems to be, hey, you know what? Whenever there's a conflict, high level, let's try to understand these four things. Let's have some truth telling. What happened?
Yeah.
Who killed who? Why? And let's just have some truth telling. And you know, we can, that historically, right, that different societies deal with conflict very different. But that's the first pillar. The second pillar is, all right, now that we have truth telling, now that we, you know, people have the countries established truth commissions through very different things. The second one is, all right, now we're going to have to have criminal prosecutions. We're going to have to prosecute some people. Some people did what in international law would be war crimes, crimes against humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Then the third pillar is, okay, we need some sort of reparations. We need some sort of, so how do we support the people whose villages were razed to the ground by militaries or guerrillas? Like, how do we implement that? Well, I mean, and it's a framework. Think about it. It's an entire country trying to rebuild, right? So it's a framework that is needed, right? And then the fourth pillar, right, in the order of operations is, all right, we need some institutional reforms. And this is where sort of my insight, my contribution to the space as a scholar in transitional justice. I started under Dr. Mark Chernick, a leading scholar in the space. Rest in peace. We lost him too early. He was subject matter expert in Colombia, the Colombia conflict. He died of a heart attack leading a peace table in Colombia. I mean, he died doing what he loved, but He really influenced my time at Georgetown quite a bit, positively. And in the institutional reform is where things tend to be not anchored by proof of work. You have all sort of human incentives. People that kill and were killed end up advocating for different things within a
and money that's money that's supposed to be for a certain cause ends up getting siphoned. Doesn't go to that cause at all. So nobody has any sort of basis on reality where this money is going, or no way to confirm it. But I love what you're saying, because it makes me think that that's why the policy is especially important, because the people right now, the people that are working for fiat, working for dollars, are wasting their time because it's getting debased constantly. And they have, until they find Bitcoin, they have no way to secure that amount of time they spend working. It just keeps getting stolen from them. So you see, again, you work harder, but like the people, as their lives get devastated and destroyed and people get hurt, when that shift comes, like you're saying, it's like the whole, like how you build up a country after it gets decimated, then the people are hurting. Now you need these reparations, you know, to kind of support the people. But when it gets to that institutional level, I think what you're saying is if you don't have sound money at the top.
Boom. You got it. I love it. That's literally the essence of my thesis. Thank you. It's literally, it's like, it typically.
I got just, like a little bit of a chest pain of like, not in a bad way. Like, and I was like, yes, like, but it was, it's
that's
like.
That's it. You got it.
Mind blowing.
Well, right. I mean, and here's sort of the feedback, you know, because I've gotten some feedback from academics and there's some tension. Right. There's some resistance. There's some openness. I have to be fair. I've gotten a little bit of everything. But what my breakthrough was, right, what my additional contribution to the field is, and it's a working paper, so I continue developing, is, hey, listen, y'all, a country needs those four pillars. We have to have truth telling first. We have to have some sort of prosecutions. Some war crimes have happened. We have to have some reparations. Sure. If we burn down the village and we kill the family of this person, we at least need to support them with some sort of little a house and, you know, something. And that happens through many, many countries, right? The fourth one is institutional reforms. As a practitioner, as a diplomat, entrepreneur, and everything, I said, okay, this is where things just become frail because the foundation is frail. So I suggest a fifth pillar.
That's what I was just going to say.
And you said it. No, you said it already, which is incredible. I say, hey, listen, I honor the scholarship that's been produced. Let's keep our four pillars. Let's add a fifth one underpinning all of it.
Right.
Let's add a fifth one underpinning to be able, you know, we're all humans. We have human incentives. But this fifth pillar can help rebuild the economies and strengthen the process if it's sound. And what's sounder than energy, right? So that's sort of where some of the feedback I've gotten from some folks, and you're monetizing justice. And I'm like, hold on.
Yeah.
Not really. It's actually sound money. And so you see folks struggling with the concept of inserting sound money as anchoring of those four pillars. But to be fair, I've gotten overall neutral and slightly positive openness from academia to this underpinning, right? So you said a lot more eloquently than I could have.
Thank you. That means a lot. But my take, again, like building off of each other, is like I was trying to say, like fixing it at the top, but when you said that first pillar is truth and the truth is weak, we have zero, like truth is literally based on, I mean, there's no truth, really. It's very, very, very weak. The foundation is crumbling. So when you add Bitcoin to the bottom, but if you kind of shape it or frame it in a way for them where it's not just because it's energy, it's because that energy is so strong around the world.
Yes.
I like the kind of the big picture of it to me is that because the energy is so strong worldwide and global and decentralized, is that nobody can change the rules of this game. Everybody plays by the same rules, and it forms truth there. Because if you don't have, because right now the system is based on lies and nobody trusts anybody. But with Bitcoin, you have a system that nobody can manipulate or change.
That's right.
So the energy backs the fact that nobody has power over another person. Yeah. Nobody can change the rules of the game, period. Like, because right now the system is built on people that are, you know, at the top, that can change the rules whenever they feel like it, and they're immune to certain rules themselves, and they're able to get away with things that they shouldn't get away with, where Bitcoin is just a level playing field for everybody. So I think that besides being the foundation, it's also like a big shield, like it's a defense mechanism for anybody trying to manipulate the rules of the game, you know? So it's very, that's why the energy to me is like, I try to, because people ask me, well, what is Bitcoin backed by? It's like, yeah, it's backed by energy, but what does that energy do? And I love to try to think about it that way, because I'm like, well, the energy protects you, you know, because no one can change it, you know? So it would be too expensive to attack Bitcoin. It's too big. And they are better off mining it at this point, because it's, and they may as well attack any other corporation or company or entity that's way easier to attack and benefit from hacking it and stealing wealth from any other group, because Bitcoin's too hard. So that's
right. To your point, the Kingdom of Bhutan is doing that. They are openly mining it. They were able to sell, I don't know how many, to sustain their expenses. Mm-hmm. And even I think they gave raises to their government employees. So they're out in the open doing it. It's you know, it's not a, it's an emerging market nation. Obviously, it's a smaller nation, but
so you see the blueprint out there.
That's right. Yeah, they open it. Yeah, they open source. They made it to the news, and they are sustainable to the point that they are able to deal. They don't even have to deal with the IMF the way El Salvador has to deal with the IMF, the way Argentina has to deal with the IMF, right? So Kingdom of Bhutan, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right. They're small enough, but they are mining it. They have a lot of hydropower. And this is all, you know, verifiable online. They are sustaining their government anchored by thermodynamic energy. That's you don't need then the IMF to come and, you know, loan you the money, right? And this obviously happens in my argument through the paper is transitional justice is necessary for countries emerging from conflict, but as a survivor myself, it's also necessary from an internal perspective. And I see that in you. I see that in Jeff Booth. I see that in myself. We have our own personal process of transitional justice as we explore Bitcoin because, and I don't know who this says, but it's a famous comedian in television that said, and I think he was talking about cryptocurrency, not just Bitcoin, but he said, cryptocurrency is everything you don't know about economics, about finance and technology all put into one. And I always laugh because that's, you know, how it you can see people struggle, right? And we even see that here at Cornell when I was fortunate enough to have crossed path with Ella Huff, an incredible rising leader. She founded the Cornell Bitcoin Club, among many other things. And I was lucky enough to be able to be a founding member of the Cornell Bitcoin Club. So I was right there interacting with, and my purview was grad school students, like, you know, introducing them to Bitcoin and just helping answer questions. And my colleagues, you see them struggling. These are folks that have been in the work for a few years. They have their undergrad. They come back to get an MBA or a PhD. And, you know, when you talk about Bitcoin, it's sort of, they're sort of setting their ways. And then some of them are open to having this process of transitional justice, right? Of seeking knowledge, right? But
you know what? I think that, you know, people are so focused because they're, you know, like that comedian said, like it's everything to do with technology and
yeah, so everything you don't know about technology, finance and econ, that's Bitcoin.
Yeah. But the funny thing about it is that because of other crypto, you're like, I don't understand the rules and how they're changing and what's happening every day. Like everything's crazy. It's like you're trying to trade, you're doing all this hectic chaos. That's right. When it comes to Bitcoin, it's almost like it reminds me, of like this old infomercial. It's like set it and forget it. Like Satoshi put it out there and he took off, you know, because it's like, you don't have to know, like, I don't know how to code. I don't understand the technicals of Bitcoin. I understand the white paper. I understand the issuance, the way the coins are coming out. I understand those things. I don't know how to C++ code. I don't get it.
For sure.
But I know what Bitcoin's protocol is. I understand how it's released over time. Those things are not hard ideas to understand. You know, once you just try to feel like, okay, how does Bitcoin work on a, what would that be called? Like on a supply schedule level, on a scarcity level, all those levels are important. But when it comes to just like the coding aspect of it, it's like, no, I didn't create it. I don't know how it works in a computer. I don't get that stuff. I know how to hold a seed phrase, how to not share a seed phrase. There's certain things that you know that once you get into Bitcoin, but you don't have to know the ins and outs. It works and it's been working and it's protecting your wealth from, you know, from thieves. And I feel like I like to remind people too that Satoshi's million coins that are still sitting in a wallet. I'm like, if anyone thinks Bitcoin can be hacked, I'm like, nobody's taken a coin, not one government.
That's right.
You know, his coin is there. So I'm like, that's proof. Like he left it there to be like, check it out. It's still working. No one's taken my coins. So until Satoshi's coins get taken, I guess then you have to start. But it's not, I mean, it's not possible. So that's, it's just, you don't have to know every detail about Bitcoin. It's just know the most important things about how it works, you know, not like the coding, you know, part of it that pretty much nobody gets, you know, there's like not that many people in the world that get that. But what you were saying is so mind blowing to me because what did you call it again? What is that called? When a country goes from devastation to reshaping it?
It's a process. When a country emerges from conflict, when conflict stops, there is a concept, a framework to help support that conflict, that country internally and externally. That's called the process of transitional justice. You're rebuilding. Okay. And it consists of typically, right, that there's some consensus in academia. It consists of four pillars: truth telling, right, criminal prosecutions, reparations, institutional reforms. If you do all of that in a crumbling economic standard, it will just crumble down. Mm-hmm. And it happens.
And that's what, oh my God, it's so important to me because I think this is something that I don't hear a lot of people talking about. Because one thing that my friend asked me yesterday, like I have ideas about how the world would be shaped. I'd call it a redistribution of wealth. You know, there's always going to be a price for someone to sell some Bitcoin. So there will always be people getting in it. It'll just keep accelerating. So I'm like, because he asked me what will happen for all the people that don't have Bitcoin since it's so, you know, such a small population of people that do own Bitcoin right now. And I just say, well, when you have a system based on sound money, like my idea before talking to you was just, it's going to benefit all people. I just think like Jeff Booth's book, The Emergence of Technology and AI will create such a boom in production and labor that the future will be deflationary because of that. So I'm thinking of this whole, you know, the idea of universal basic income. But when you have it based on lies, and when you don't have some kind of sound money, it's like that could still be stolen from you as that dollar continues to just, you know, wither away. And I think that you need to have what you're talking about. If you have those pillars in place, you think, I never really thought about, okay, that population, the people that didn't get into Bitcoin, it's like you against your will had your time and energy stolen from you through a medium of exchange that is constantly inflated.
Correct.
So you were attacked, stolen from, your time is worthless. Like the time you spend working is more and more worthless. So these people are attacked and their lives get hard. So again, yeah, you do see this crumbling of society. You see pain everywhere. So it would lead to what you're saying ultimately is like that. A country need help. The people of the country need help. And how are you going to do that? And it's happened in other places and they have to support the country. Like it's not like it's never happened before, right? Like this in history, like there's history of times where there's been collapse and rebirth of a country. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so and adding to this, and I think, I don't know what excites me when I hear you sort of, you know, I put an idea out, but obviously I love this. I love when people just start making their own sort of analysis, right? And if I can add to your perspective, I think there's only 21 million coins. And then I'm thinking of the question you said your friend said, what happens to the people that didn't get in? Well, what I will answer, right, is Bitcoin doesn't just benefit the person that's holding in self-custody. obviously that's part of the ethos, right? Of and Bitcoin Policy Institute is actively, you know, that's one of the principles that they're founded on is, you know, listen, right to, you know, thermodynamically mined proof of work, right to, you know, host self custody. Like those are things regulators actively are trying to attack, and we need folks like Bitcoin Policy Institute to push and argue for those rights, right? We have to earn, we have to fight for those rights. In DC, only winners last. And to win, you have to put in the work. So I think that if I had the opportunity to chat with your friend, it would go something like, Bitcoin is replacing, right, eventually on a long enough horizon, right, decades, is going to be part of a sound layer of money where government gets built. And again, shout out to BPI, and they put out something that's called the concept of the bit bond, the bit bonds. People, country, entire nation states can issue bit bonds and use fiat to support whatever development, whatever expenses they might have. But it is also supporting and founded on an asset that's appreciating, on thermodynamically bounded, right? So that, you know, and there's a spectrum, right? There's a spectrum of, I don't know where your friend falls in. I want zero government in my life, or I want all the government and everything in between. But regardless of, you know, and honestly, the only win in DC, if you build coalitions, that's the only way to win enough momentum. So we need all of that. And in the Bitcoin community, I join many spaces, and I have very, very good, I have a lot of respect for people that do the spaces on a daily basis. I know you're active in the Bitcoin army as well, which I love seeing I believe Michelle is her name. She does this post introducing and announcing the members like every day. It's just such a sweet and thoughtful community that, think about it. If a member is in Australia, El Salvador, or Texas, Michelle announces it. And there's an inclusion in a decentralized, like we become a community in a decentralized way. It's such a new way of thinking, right? That not everybody that is, you know, not everybody agrees with it, and not everybody will join, and that's okay. So,
and not too many people, even in other communities, you're right, they don't do the shout outs for the new members. Nobody does that work and cares about showing off a post and, you know, putting that time in to do that. But it's like you care that this community is growing and we support each other, and there's not that many out there like that. I don't You know what I mean?
No, there's, there's cycles. Obviously, I remember, you know, I was around the bear market in 2017. Something came up that before Spaces, it was called Clubhouse. And that was sort of a whole different thing. So there, every cycle brings different sort of dynamics of community building, right? And to see this, you know, I think you're also in another community that celebrates daily buying, I think,
yes,
DCA,
yes,
which I think
buy daily.
I love it. Because about it. If I smash by $2 a day because I have a minimum wage job and that's all I can afford, or I'm smashed by $200 a day, that still gets celebrated, and you're shepherding that, and you're like, that's literally Bitcoin in the sense of, hey, listen, I respect you. If you only feel comfortable putting $2 or $200, I'm still here to support you and celebrate you.
And not only that, it's you're celebrating the people during a time where, you know, when the Bitcoin price is stagnant, people are like, should I wait till it drops or wait till it, you know, it's like, no, buy today. What's the difference? And then if you wait till it drops, and people are sometimes those people that are newer to Bitcoin and they get scared off, like maybe I shouldn't buy more, it might drop further. Just buy it again, you know, just keep buying it. And then if it's at the top, it's like we like to say that we like to buy the top, middle, the bottom, because the top, it kind of also makes us feel like our little contribution to buying a little bit of extra Bitcoin can help maybe like tip that scale to like get some of those shorts to get wrecked, you know, those people that are shorting Bitcoin. So either way, we're like, we don't care. And if it averages out, so whatever the price is over time, doesn't matter. You know, so as long as you're consistently buying, you're growing your Bitcoin stack. And we like to show people that, like, you know, the people that don't do that yet, that it's just, you know, don't be afraid. You're just growing your savings. It doesn't matter if the price swings up and down, whatever it does. And during times, if there is a large drop off again, like there was, which I don't personally see that happening with all the adoption going on, you know, politically and, you know, through the, you know, TradFi system, I mean, I don't see a huge drop off like we used to have just because of the amount of demand that there is. But again, like if there is a big drop, it's just on sale. So you just get to buy extra, you know, because it will just keep coming back. So I love that community too. I think it's so important. And I think that it's just such an important way to think about the future, because not a lot of people think about how people are being affected on a large scale, and how, you know, policy could help, and how rebuilding could help. These people, you know, a sound money future is just the way to go. We can't continue to allow, you know, theft to get away. And I think it, like you said, like the growing number of Americans too, when you were mentioning the politicians running for president, as they see more Bitcoiners, you know, growing, they need to, you know, so it's almost like those people will help that sound money become a base pillar foundation. And then like you were, I think also mentioning was about all those people that say, what if I didn't buy any Bitcoin?
That's right.
And you think about the people that are just the long-term holders in cold storage, in a way that also does benefit them, like you said too, because if that Bitcoin isn't moving, then it becomes more and more scarce. So there's less coming out every 4 years. And as adoption's growing and people aren't selling, it's only going to make that more valuable. So whatever they do buy into, if they smash buy daily, if they're buying a little Bitcoin every day, that's going to keep rising more as people are holding stronger. So it's almost like, it's not like, oh, I'm mad at you because you're having your Bitcoin in cold storage and not selling. You're reducing the supply in the markets, benefiting anybody else who's getting into it too. So because a lot of these people, they aren't planning on selling unless they absolutely need it for their retirement or for their kids or something. It's amazing to think about.
I agree. And, you know, we're living through it, Stacey. We're literally living through that look at what you're doing. Like, you're literally interviewing incredible, you know, and I love your interview with Jeff Booth and Larry. Like, you're really just sourcing these incredible thinkers to share what they had seen a while ago and is already happening, right? And we're so early. Like, I remember I had a conversation with someone last week who said, it feels too late for me to buy a Bitcoin. I'm medium class, middle class. I have two kids, you know, married, and I can't afford one. Can I buy a little bit of it, or is it just one? That's how early we are, and that's how this person just heard the news and said, "Oh, Bitcoin is at 100."
I can't believe that.
Well, it's real, you know.
You're right. I mean, I can believe it because I do hear people that still don't get that. But as a Bitcoiner, you think, "Yeah, you could buy $1 of Bitcoin. Doesn't matter." Crazy how many people out there still think, "Well, I can't get a whole one." You know, like that's not for me. I've missed the boat.
Go ahead, please.
Sorry. I was even talking about with my husband how back in, we were looking up earlier today when Coinbase actually started. It was in 2012. And I remember hearing about Bitcoin in 2015 from a friend, and I still didn't get into it till 2020. Because when I heard about it, we were just like, what is that? That's weird. Why would somebody pay for something that we totally didn't understand? And I was thinking here in 2015, it was probably like you had to meet up in an internet cafe and trade Bitcoin through laptops. But no, Coinbase was around since 2012, and you were able to buy it for like, I don't know if it was $6. I don't remember the amount, but it was so
yeah.
Imagine. And there was a way to get on the website, go to coinbase.com, and you could buy Bitcoin on Coinbase. It wasn't like you had to be a hacker to buy Bitcoin in 2012. But that's how little I knew, even in 2015, and even till I actually did it in 2020. And it doesn't mean you're too late. Just, you know, like when we say the majority of the world, I think most people won't ever have like 0.01 Bitcoin, you know, so that's how little bit is left for if we have only 1.3% adoption globally. And we have 8 billion people in the world.
That's right.
That's all you kind of like. I kind of just tell people, like, think about how scarce it is and how it's growing. It's only supply and demand. Just think supply and demand.
That's right.
So it's, but that's how crazy it is to think about that people still ask you these questions.
Oh, yeah. You know, and by the way, people with a lot of degrees, you know, there's a lot of education, a lot of degrees. But degrees does not necessarily equate with, you know, there's some, degrees is a tool that you can use to employ in whatever it is you want to do, right? But just having degrees doesn't itself do anything, right? You have to put it to work. And I think that, you know, and I'm grateful you alluded to my profile, because I spent several days thinking on what to put there. So I feel very validated that you like connecting dots with Bitcoin, because I literally
do that all the time. Like, my husband always tells me that, like, that is like my favorite thing to do. Like, I like connecting the ideals and the principles of Bitcoin to either health or like science or, you know, any like patterns, you know, like I connect. There's so many things about Bitcoin that can connect to so many parts of your life. So I do that all the time. He would always joke that I was like the GIF with the red string, like the guy with the red string that was trying to, you know, like put ideas together and figure stuff out. Cause I'm like, it's like a huge puzzle that I'm like, wait, how do these things, you know, go together? Like there must be like and I think that Bitcoin, once you realize Bitcoin, it's awesome. That's why when I saw that it was like, oh, cool. That's like how I feel. Because it's like you're very, you realize kind of that all these dots that you're trying to connect was missing something.
Yes.
And it kind of reminds me of how they try to understand space. And there's all this space between space that they call dark matter that's like really holding everything all together. And I think Bitcoin could be that, that like dark matter of like really like the thing that you can't touch, but it's really holding it all together. That's like how Bitcoin could be, is like, whatever, is like a invisible power of gravitational force that's holding it all together.
That's right.
So it's just,
I love it.
Crazy.
You know, and I don't know if you've had time to look at the most recent, what was the conference that Mr. Saylor went, Bitcoin Prague, I think the most recent one that he went, after Vegas. And he mentioned sort of the energy component, right? It's always incredible to see how he connects the dots, but the energy component, it's such a critical, you know, when I love your podcast for the reason your education work. People think, oh, that's energy in the grid, I don't care about it. Or, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but no, energy is everywhere. I mean, energy is how we get our water delivered. You know, and I think Mr. Saylor was saying in one of his presentations, what happens in a country where, you know, you have no water, you have no electricity, where that's frail, where that's very fragile, those infrastructures, then you're going to have less progress. What happens when these basic services are grounded by sound monetary policy, by a sound monetary asset, a commodity like Bitcoin? Then it allows for all this infrastructure to be built in a resilient way that, you know, energy is life, energy is growth. We need more energy, not less, in the universe, particularly with AI, with this conversation via Zoom.
And to harness, you know, to harness nature's energy, because what I think that is, sorry to cut you off. I feel like I'm so ADD.
We're both passionate.
I feel terrible when I do it. Okay. So that's literally, I'm always jumping in. But what I think about that is that, what I like to talk about with people is human greed, because all these companies that have warehouses full of supercomputers, they argue that Bitcoin's bad for the earth because it takes up too much energy to mine Bitcoin. But Bitcoin actually will help the world go green because of human greed. Because if people want to preserve their profits from Bitcoin mining, they don't want to pay half of their, you know, profits to the electricity company. They're trying to figure out ways to preserve that wealth. So they were like, okay, what alternative solutions can we do to, you know, provide energy for this Bitcoin mining that isn't going to cost us all this money? So it incentivizes companies to go green because they're greedy. So this also brings all these solutions, because people that normally wouldn't take the time to figure out how they could do it, to use energy and like, create energy in a green way, solar energy, wind, water, you know, volcanoes, all these things, people will figure out a way because there's a need to do it. You know, there's a necessary, because Bitcoin is profitable, so you will do it, but you want to do it in the cheapest way possible. So that's why all this is possible, because if Bitcoin is like paving the way for more companies to figure out solutions.
That's right.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's happening right now. We have miners. I mean, in Bhutan, there's mining. I mean, it's everywhere. So I, you know, let me tell you an interesting story that from my time doing the MBA in Cornell, they brought a speaker, several speakers, and class I had, it was sort of like emerging markets and finance, something to that end. And it was more like markets, like capital markets. So they brought folks from institutional investors, from the European Union, one from an Asian, a market in Asia, the Asian continent, another one from South America. And I brought up the question of Bitcoin, right? It was like maybe 10, 15 of us in that class. And I said, what's your take? You're on, you know, it was a sort of a chat and house rules, right? You can't really repeat by what the person said, but you can kind of, you can't name it, but you can repeat it. And he said, well, can we enforce the chat and house rules? And we all laugh. We're like, of course, yeah, we're adults, you know, just being honest here. And this is folks that manage, you know, institutional investors, right? And two of them confirmed they have bought it personally as a hedge, specifically after Larry Fink went in. They name drop Larry Fink.
Right.
And they appreciated that Fidelity had been doing it for many years, since 2014, I believe. The Fidelity has been one of the originals. They self-custody, they were mining us, they mine us. I mean, it's incredible. But they said, because Larry Fink filed, we bought it on a personal note. And I said, what does that say about sort of what you do? Like, what does that mean in your job? Does it threaten it? And he said, one, Bitcoin is too small of an asset. For us to take it seriously, it needs to be about $500,000, closer to $1 million. When it gets to those levels, then we start considering it. Right now, it's not even our radar. Mm-hmm. But we did buy it just in case.
Right.
It blew my mind.
It's true.
This is traditional finance.
Like, you know, all this, when they say that Bitcoin's going after the market cap of the world, that adds up to about $500 trillion, that includes gold and real estate as a store of value to store their, you know, store their value for the future. That's what Bitcoin's going after. So it's a $500 trillion market cap. And what is it at now? Two point something?
2.1 or 2.2. Yeah. Less than 2.5.
And it's growing. Yeah. It's growing fast and it's eating into those markets. But it's if people want to, I mean, literally, if there's $500 trillion in gold and real estate and things that people do to store their value, that is a giant market. And if all that money flows into Bitcoin tomorrow, that'd be, you know, I mean, it'd be insane. So that it has to slowly get there. You know, it's like these people can adopt slowly. They could get some, but they can't fully go all in with what they want to go all in with, because if every person in the world does that, it has the capital to do that. It would be too much. You know, it would just blow up the price right away, and it would just be chaos, you know, chaos for the dollar, chaos for the world. So I think people are just that's why I kind of like to compare it to like all this, the people with a lot of capital in the world. It's like they're walking a minefield when they're buying Bitcoin, because to me, it feels like they want to buy more, because the way we feel, we want to buy when we have extra cash. We're like, let's collect more Bitcoin. That's how we save our money. I know these companies want to do it. The people that get it, they want to do it. The governments that want to do it, the states that want to put it on their treasury. But if all these people just tomorrow said, let's just go all in and put what we have because we know Bitcoin's the way to go, and if everyone does the same thing, it's like, I think everyone's just playing the game. Like, they're tiptoeing around like the price. They're collecting what they can without moving the market too much.
That's right.
And eventually that scarcity will kick in at the same time that everyone does kind of, you know, once it grows big enough. And it's going to be growing big enough. I don't know. It's just a crazy idea to think about how that all works.
Bitcoin is divisible, right? It's not like we are going to have nation states. I don't know if you're following the corporate treasury trends. Michael Saylor has, I believe, accumulated a lead of 600,000, something like that. There's announcements of companies acquiring 60, 50. Yes. So it's already happened. Like, we're seeing that.
Yes, it is.
Replace companies with eventually countries, with institutions, with pension funds, where, you know, and obviously Michael Saylor.
That's the amazing part.
That's right. It's incredible. I mean, divisible. It's so empowering to see the market already doing it.
Yes. And it's amazing because it actually gives people a chance to become some of the ultra wealthy. Because right now, if the largest capital managers in the world can't go in and put everything they have into Bitcoin, because it needs to be bigger for them to do it, because they're going to totally move the market if they do so, then the companies that are smaller have a chance to build their Bitcoin treasury during this time. So it's like all the smaller companies have a chance to do this as these big companies are slowly doing it. So it's like everyone's almost level.
That's right.
Like everyone's allowed to get what they can without completely cheating. Because if they cheat and buy the whole supply tomorrow, like if BlackRock wants to go buy the last 2 million coins on the market that are, he's going to, first of all, it's technically like you can't cheat because now the market will skyrocket to who knows how many trillions, like millions of dollars a coin. Then people could dump on BlackRock. And then, you know what I mean? People could be like, well, we're going to sell because BlackRock was, you know, they bought that much. It's just market dynamics. So they really can't, but they could just say, well, we own it all now. So what are you going to do? There's not much coming out. It's literally like just like an interesting game theory kind of play. But I love that it gives people the chance to get in before these institutions could really, you know, put a ton of their capital in it. And I think even Strike is talking about, you know, their whole proof of reserves, which is nice. And they're talking about, you know, saying that Jack Mallers, he's saying he's competitive. He's like, I want to even try to get past Strategy, which I don't know how, because they started in 2020. So I don't know how that could be possible, but we'll see how this game theory plays out. It's very interesting.
You know, and I think that I agree with sort of, you know, your overall perspective when it comes to the free market ultimately being, the free market decides, right? And there's a link, and I'll send it to you afterwards. But Larry Fink, and this is a few months ago, he was at some sort of conference, and I don't quite remember, but I'm paraphrasing here. He said something to the end of, and I saw the article yesterday. If the world knew or understood Bitcoin or allocated 2%, Bitcoin would go to $700,000. And for, you know, from somebody that we have seen, you know, Mr. Fink's evolution from, I think he called it an index of money laundering back in 2018-ish to now being the best and biggest ETF performers for his firm to him. Yeah. For him to say those prices, you know, it, he's validating what you have, what you're seeing, what Jeff Booth has seen. It's just that to your point, Bitcoin doesn't care. It's like, if you want to buy everything, well, you can't inflate it away. So, but you're going to have to pay of, you know, it's going to have to go to 700 and then 1.4 and then double. So to hear smart money, Wall Street, as they will say, talk about things that with our proof of work, you know, you have understood, you spread the message. I've understood. Jeff Booth has understood it. It's just so validating to know, okay, you know, we were not wrong. We were early. But sometimes being early can feel like you're wrong, and the market can arbitrage that, right? It's like, oh yeah, you know what? You're too late. So here, have mine. This is the next one. And that's sort of where particularly education, I tip my hat to the educators like yourself. It's needed. We need more of this in a decentralized way. I mean, we need it to help folks understand. At the end of the day, though, we can't, you know, we live in a democratic society. We can't force people to do things. So people will decide where they want to park my $20 or $200, right? And back on tying this back to your community, the fact that you celebrate, you know, the smash buys, I love it, you know, because there's sort of decentralized ways of strengthening them, right? But Wall Street is on it, and it's all public statements. I'll send you the link so we can put that out on the podcast.
Yeah. I want you to send those over to me too. And I want to just kind of like summarize this because it just feels like, you know, what I kind of feel like I want to relate to people in this video is that for those of people who think they're late to Bitcoin, or for the people that get left behind because they, you know, well, Bitcoin is bad for countries because all the people that are going to be left behind. It seems like in this type of situation where you're talking about, you know, collapse or like country, like devastation in countries. If Bitcoin is the underpinning, if Bitcoin is the foundation to these pillars, it will still save them. You know? So whether it will like be better for all people if it underpins the entire political systems in these countries. So that's an incredibly powerful idea.
I will concur with you. I agree. I think that, you know, and I heard somebody said this on I don't know who it was, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something to the end of, you can't eat Bitcoin, but it can allow you to source high quality food. And you know, I agree with you. I can't eat Bitcoin, but it allows me to have that space, that time. And you were alluding to it, right? How society looked like on a sound monetary basis? What about UBI? What about that? And you really start getting in the weeds of policy of, okay, so if we do bit bonds, as share on the white paper by BPI, which is incredible. I'll send you the link too. I think everybody should read it. What does that mean for the policies? And mm-hmm. and then you get into this incredible dynamic of game theory, right? Bhutan is mining Bitcoin, El Salvador bought Bitcoin. Some states, I believe Texas and New Hampshire, have passed laws allowing. I believe Texas already deployed $10 million. So you're starting to see the spectrum, right? And it's like, all right, if I incorporate Bitcoin, how would that look for my community, for the people that have put me in office? How can I serve them? What can I create? And just like Michael Saylor has done an incredible feat of financial engineering, you know, backed by thermodynamic, something thermodynamic, that now everyone is, he inspired an entire category, right? He broke the model of the, for MBAers, for CFAs. I think the Bitcoin idea is something that will only strengthen the network, and it obviously will help rebuild societies. You know, again, it won't feed them, but it allowed them to rebuild on a better foundation, which obviously societies in different continents look very different based on cultures. And, you know, that's a whole different conversation, but at least they have the soundness of it to yes. better pursue their goals. So I that's a beautiful framing, by the way. And I like it. I agree with it.
Thank you. And I just love everything you've talked about today. And I can't wait to see how you share it, because it really just feels like Bitcoin is a way, because right now people think of politics as just toxic and it's all lies, like a system based on that very foundation that we're saying it is based on. But it seems like this new policy that could be in Bitcoin can create a government that serves its people again, correct, instead of stealing from its people again.
It can help.
So it's such a, I think people, yeah, their ideas will shift and change, and it'll be more for advocacy for the people, for support for the people, for care, and like just a whole better world. It just sounds amazing. So, and one last thing I want to say to you before we go today, and I want you to share where people could find you too, but I wanted to say that there was somebody who, weirdly enough, like the coincidence that happens sometimes in life is just something that I don't think is coincidence, but you know, you're here talking about policy, and on the same day I get an email from two people on X, Jeff Hilsenbeck and Tim Niemeyer. I don't know if I said their names wrong, but they asked me to be part of this Illinois Bitcoin Council, where their idea is to help, because we're in the state of Illinois, to help Illinois politicians see the benefits of implementing Bitcoin in the political system in Illinois. I said, yes, I'll join. We're planning on having a get together. It's like a few of us already. They even have a website going, IllinoisBitcoinCouncil.org. Yeah, and they have a lot of information on how mining can benefit, how right. having a, you know, a fund that like is almost like a, I think a multi-sig fund, or I just literally got it this morning. I haven't had a chance to check on all the work they've done, but it looks like they put already together a really great website with very educational content. So whatever I can do to further the education in Illinois and policy changes, what a weird coincidence, right? Like, isn't that crazy?
Listen, it is the proof of work. And I think Jeff Booth alluded to this in your podcast, where when you start allocating little by little, not everybody can just drop their fiat job and work full time in Bitcoin, right? But when you start looting and when you start allocating to Bitcoin, you start getting rewarded by something that's being inflated away every year. Rather, it's being preserved and increases in value. So this is the beginning of your long and upcoming trajectory of incredibly high quality impact. I think that you are a, you know, full signal educator, leader in the space. And I think that in general, Illinois is lucky to have you. I'm excited to celebrate all the impact you're going to have. This is great. And I'm in the East Coast, so happy to drive and, you know, be part of the community. As I think in general, we're all in this together. But congratulations. That's incredible.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I thought it was the coolest thing. And I knew that I was talking to you today. So I'm like, I definitely have to remember to share that with him. So yeah, it's exciting to see that whatever role you could play in helping people to, you know, understand it and helping even policymakers, because as much as people think policy isn't important in Bitcoin and you're against that, it very much is, as far as to help the rest of the people also. It's not just about the people that made it and got out in time. You know, it's just about helping the entire, you know, everybody around you. So yeah, I love that. I love this whole talk. Where can people find you then? So you're going to be releasing your Substack soon,
yes.
Today maybe?
Yes, hopefully. If not today, it will be okay, tomorrow morning.
We'll see. No pressure.
You will be at it. I'm adding you as well. You're actually in my category of winners in educators and journalists. You are right there. And I think that people can find me several ways. The first one, the fastest one probably will be my X handle, which is sal_pineda1, PINEDA 1. And the website, that's going live soon, hopefully tomorrow, which also will have the links to all my work and ways to connect and whatnot. Happy to chat with anybody, put 15 minutes of Cal invite. And I was able to set that up to connect with folks in the space. That would be salpineda.com. So sal, PINEDA.com. And live on X, live to just, you know, always looking to connect with folks. And no, thank you again for the opportunity. This is great. I'll send you the links so folks can kind of explore what we talked about. And yeah, I mean, onwards and forwards. This is awesome. Thank you for all you do in the space, Stacey.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been such a great talk and very eye-opening.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss new content.